I think I successfully did the thing for recording that, so that's good.
It sounded like.
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, thank you for the instructions. How's everybody doing?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'll be driving, Kelly, so.
Sure thing. I'll try not to make it so engaging that you can concentrate on the road.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. That would be good.
or the converse. Anya, is it getting fall-like there?
Oh, it's beautiful. We did our fall tour along the Mississippi yesterday.
Oh, really?
And it's gorgeous.
Nice.
It must be gorgeous in Vermont, huh?
Yeah, it's coming along. I don't think it's quite at peak yet, but it's definitely coming along. And it's been very, very dry.
Oh.
So it seems to be even more so than usual.
Yeah. But it must be really beautiful once it peaks.
Yeah, it was, and it was, Saturday was gorgeous out, so that was nice.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff, good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
Good, how are things in Vermont COVID-wise?
We are exceptional, actually, in terms of we've been hovering at well under 1% positivity rate, so we've actually fared quite well, I must say. So that's been fortunate. Everybody's kind of concerned for the twin billing of flu and that in the fall, though.
Yeah.
It's the weather turns.
Then do people have to wear masks in your environment, or how's that?
Yeah, work? Yeah. And we've got these plexiglass shields up in the multi-headed scopes based on no – well, I better not say that. I'm not sure what data that's based on, but
Yeah,
we'll just leave it at that. Yeah, I don't know. Are you guys signing – are you guys double-heading?
Yep.
Yeah.
We are. But we have a limited number of people in the room, and everyone has to be masked. We haven't put
up
a plexiglass shield.
Yes, got it. All right, everybody. Well, good morning. I think it's 9:15. Get started. We have a exciting lineup of journal articles for this month. Not the least of which is from several of the esteemed members of this group, including Mayo Clinic Associates. And it talks about the issue of granulomatous interstitial lung disease, or GLILD for short. And what the group wanted to do, they gathered together cases from Rochester and Arizona, Mayo, and as well as from Dr. Churg's group at the University of British Columbia to look at GLILD and patients with common variable immune deficiency and selective immunoglobulin A deficiency. And they asked whether those two entities could be distinguished from each other and whether any of the histologic features in either of those correlated with outcome, and finally, whether one could use GLILD specifically as a distinct entity of histopathologic features. So this was a retrospective review, and they gleaned these cases from both or all three of the institutions in a retrospective look back, and five pulmonary pathologists. I gather it was all the Mayo. So let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. No, I guess it was all the pathologists involved in the study. Hopefully, and that's one of my questions about the case, that was done at an exotic location because otherwise some of the study has less merit. So we'll be interested to hear if anyone on the call can divulge where this gathering was done. But nonetheless, They met and looked at a very specific set of criteria for histopathology and imagine scored that in a big Excel table. And then they, as far as inclusion criteria, the inclusion criteria for common variable immune deficiency as well as IgA deficiency were through standard definitions that were set clinically. People with CVID had to have lower than normal serum IgG levels and along with low IgA or M levels and then poor antibody response to a challenge. And, of course, exclusion of other entities. Whereas selective immunoglobulin A deficiency, of course, required isolated IgA deficiency and then exclusion of other causes. And quite simply, GLIALD was defined as any combination of some form of lymphoid proliferation with plus granulomas. So what they were able to gather actually was a fairly impressive number of CVID cases. There were 34. Less cases of IgA deficiency, 4 of those. And as far as the histopathologic features that they found, what was present in a large majority of these cases were non-caseating granulomas. And they mentioned that they were usually in air spaces. 68% of CVID patients and half of those with IgA deficiency had these. It was noted that only a few of the cases of CVID had features that were somewhat reminiscent of sarcoid, either this concentric perilaminar, peripheral laminar fibrosis or a lymphangitic pattern was seen. And curiously, although we think about CVID as not something that has abundant plasma cells, in about a quarter of CVID patients, they were readily identified. And three-quarters of IgA-deficient patients had easily identifiable plasma cells. Only a few cases were eosinophils present. And then, as might be expected, a marked majority of both CVID and IgA-deficient patients had some form of lymphoid proliferation. It ranged from follicular bronchiolitis to lymphoid hyperplasia that could either be nodular or diffuse, LIP or a cellular NFIP pattern. And there really wasn't any difference between CVID and IgA deficient patients in terms of the patterns of lymphoid proliferation that they had. About three-quarters of CVID patients had organizing pneumonia and half of IgA deficient patients did. And that didn't seem to correlate with whether or not they had granulomas. A minority to half of patients had some form of bronchiectasis or bronchiolectasis. And as far as features that were defined as GLIALD, 68% of CVID patients had that and 50% of IgA deficient patients had that. There was pleuritis in a minority of patients. Follow-up wasn't available in all the patients, which I suppose kind of limits the takeaway of the clinical significance of the findings. But importantly, in the CVID patients for which most had follow-up, 3 had lymphoma and 1 died from that. Another CVID patient died from an untreatable pulmonary infection. But importantly, it appeared that granulomas weren't associated with outcome. And all of the 3 out of the 4 IgA-deficient patients were alive at follow-up. So the conclusion that was gathered from this is that GLIALD isn't a specific entity and that it can be seen in both CVID and IgA-deficient patients, and that there isn't a specific parameters of histopathologic features that distinguish these groups of patients. So the admonishment is not necessary to use GLIALD as something specific that in the prior literature has contended to be something that's specific for CVID because it can be seen in other settings, adverse drug, connective tissue, other diseases. And then an important pearl when looking at cases that show this constellation of findings, think about these entities, CVID or IDA deficiency, especially patients who are younger and have recurrent pneumonias. So I thought that this was a nice study of looking at a constellation of histopathologic findings that people have attributed some specificity to, and really taken a step back and thought about it a little bit more and pulled back from, this is a pattern that isn't necessarily specific for these entities. Anybody else have any thoughts or comments about this?
So does it mean you can call something, or you can discuss with the clinician that this might be CLILT even though we might not see granulomas?
Well, I think it's the dog wagging the tail wagging the dog, in terms of at least how it was defined for this study, is that GLILD was defined for this as having to have granulomas plus a lymphoid proliferation. So I think that was their commentary. So I guess I don't know. I'd love to hear if any of the other authors have any commentary on that.
I don't know if any, but this is Henry. I don't know if anybody else is on and they want to speak up. But it was, you know, Scottsdale in the winter, in January, if you're from Vancouver or Rochester, it's pretty exotic. So that's the exotic location.
Fair enough.
But it was the middle of January. So, you know, the part of the point of this was, we don't think the term GLILD is actually a worthwhile term. I mean, clinicians are still going to use it, but because so many of the cases don't actually have granulomas but have this kind of funny, odd constellation, which includes kind of a funny organizing pneumonia with a lot of the granulomas kind of caught up in the areas of organizing pneumonia, to suggest immunodeficiency syndrome in such cases but not use the term GLILD. But I'm sure it will continue to be used, just like BAC continues to be used.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Another question I had was, it wasn't entirely clear to me whether, from the methods, whether these patients came in with a diagnosis of their IgA deficiency, or that was something that was suggested when the pathology was seen in consultation and then the patients were found to have that. It just makes me wonder how many times the pathologist guess this and then the clinicians go back versus vice versa. And I don't know, Henry, if you recollect any sense of that.
Well, I can say that it was a little bit of both.
For
months trying to get follow-up on some of these patients just to see what had happened, and to get IgG levels and so on. So in our teaching set, some of them were, you know, question mark GLILD or, you know, question mark CVID kinds of cases. And then we went back and got follow-up. That's a great question. I just don't remember the answer to that. It would be hard to dig, but some were pathologist suggested for sure.
Yeah, so I was just wondering if just from a practical standpoint, when you see cases that have a, in quotes, GLILD morphology, if you go ahead and suggest that for them to get some immunoglobulin levels in your letter and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Just had a case within the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Henry, I have a question. My recollection from the original study where they used that term GLILD was that not all the cases had all those features to begin with, but I don't remember exactly.
No, yeah, Tom, you're exactly right. And so the same is true in some of the, I think the Rao paper, which is the second or third, maybe one of the larger pathology studies, didn't have that either. So, I mean, I think it was a bad name from the beginning, and it continues to be a bad name, in my opinion.
All right. Any other commentary about that? So some nice pictures, nice photomicrographs in there to check out as well. All right. So it wouldn't be Journal Club without talking about the latest, greatest marker for malignant mesothelioma. So not to disappoint in terms of that, our next article is from Dr. Churg and colleagues at Vancouver talking about Hedge 1, something that Anya had brought up a couple of months ago, and finally we're here to talk about it, so long awaited at last. And the question is Hedge 1 all that for the diagnosis of malignant mesothelioma? So just like in many other studies that have been done on new mesothelial markers, tissue microarrays were utilized. They included a cadre of benign and malignant mesothelial proliferations, reactive epithelial proliferations, reactive spindled ones, epithelioid mesothelioma, sarcomatoid ones, as well as non-small cell carcinomas, representing both adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. And also included were high-grade serous ovarian carcinoma. And then they also looked at type B3 thymomas. And for those, instead of tissue microarrays, they used whole slides. There was a mouse monoclonal Hedge 1 antibody used, and there were some gymnastics that one had to get through in terms of understanding what was considered positive staining for this study. So in epithelioid mesothelioma, only membranous staining was considered positive. But they said per the difficulty of separating out cytoplasm and membrane and spindle proliferations for sarcomatoid, either membranous or cytoplasmic was considered positive. So when they looked at epithelioid malignant mesothelioma, what they found was that 94% stained positively membranously in a strongly and effusively positive fashion for Hedge 1. 44% of sarcomatoids stained, but the staining was usually more moderately intense in comparison to the epithelioids. And then importantly, I think that a point that was underemphasized in my personal opinion in this study was that 18% of high-grade ovarian serous carcinomas stained for Hedge 1, but they said that the staining was focal and it was only weak to moderate intensity. As far as reactive mesothelial proliferations, 88% that were epithelioid stained and 34% of reactive spindle cell proliferations did. And of those reactive spindled ones, it was usually weak and focal. As far as other entities, carcinomas and B3 thymomas did not show membranous Hedge 1 staining. However, in carcinomas, there was some weak cytoplasmic staining in a minority of cases. They said the sensitivity for Hedge 1 was in epithelioid mesothelium was comparable to standard markers, calretinin, WT1, and the like. But for sarcomatoid mesotheliomas, it was also similarly sensitive in sarcomatoid, but of course the sensitivity there was lower. It was 44%. But that was in range of more traditional mesothelial markers. And it was noted that all of the epithelioid mesotheliomas that were Hedge 1 positive also stained with two or more conventional markers. So the conclusions that were reached are that Hedge 1 is similarly sensitive to other conventional mesothelial markers for epithelioid mesothelioma when one is looking at separating it from non-small cell lung carcinoma, but that it has higher specificity than conventional markers. And it's got a similar sensitivity to conventional markers for sarcomatoid mesothelioma, but it lacks specificity, or excuse me, it strike that last sentence, it lacks sensitivity for sarcomatoid mesotheliomas and it isn't much better than conventional markers. So what to take away from this is I don't believe this is going to solve all of our issues in that it didn't seem as though there were cases in which Hedge 1 saved the day in that in epithelioid malignant mesothelioma as the cases also seen for other markers. They advocate that it's got higher specificity, but remember that it's only in the realm of separating it from non-small cell lung cancer. I do find it concerning for peritoneal mesothelioma is that high-grade serous ovarian will stain, and so I think that's definitely an area of concern. And my real concern is that it doesn't seem like it's necessarily straightforward for people who don't use mesothelial markers all the time to adopt this in terms of you have to make sure that it's staining. It was somewhat underemphasized that there can be cytoplasmic staining, albeit usually weak and staining in carcinomas. And so that's my take on it. One has to also be concerned that vascular endothelium also stains. And so I think the jury's out on whether it's as good as the authors say it is in terms of that increased specificity, but I think there is some concern with interpretation of the stain. Open for discussion.
Did they say they're going to use it routinely?
Well, to read into their wording, they go so far as to say that they find it to be a better marker and advocate at the very last conclusion that it may obviate the need for other mesothelial markers to confirm a diagnosis. So that's pretty strongly worded, imploring that you could probably get away with just using Hedge 1 and not a panel. But I'd certainly be concerned in the peritoneum at the very least.
Kelly, do I understand that correctly? They really only use TMAs? Because I think that's the first report of Hedge 1 in mesothelioma, so I'm a bit surprised that all the conclusions are based on TMAs. Makes me a little worried, I have to say, without seeing a whole tissue section.
Yeah, as far as I can see, it was all TMAs except for they used 10 whole slides of type B3 thymoma. And it does make one wonder in terms of are we capturing the right area and the heterogeneity, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So anyway, food for thought, Hedge 1.
I'll hedge my bets on that one.
I was waiting. Boom, boom. Very nice. Very nice. All right. Thank you, Tom. Well, we'll move on to something more morphologically based here. And the next article I have for you is from a group out of Germany, and it looks at lesions in the lung that appear to be biphasic, but in fact have entrapped respiratory epithelium, and so they mimic a metastatic or primary biphasic neoplasm of the lung. And although this was published in Virchow's, I actually thought it was a pretty interesting problem that hasn't been well addressed in the surgical pathology literature, at least to my eye, and I really feel like it probably was something of the quality that could have gotten into AGSP or something like that. But be that as it may, I thought it was an interesting study. And it was a single institution in Germany. And what they did was they looked at both primary and metastatic intrapulmonary neoplasms that were other than carcinomas during a six-year period. And they called those and found cases that had entrapment or respiratory epithelium. They got 47 surgical lung resected cases, 38 were metastatic, the others were primary pulmonary non-epithelial neoplasms. And out of those, just under half had respiratory epithelium that was entrapped. And of those, there were 15 in which it was diffuse. The rest, it was peripheral or focal. And so what they did with those 15 cases is that they examined them a bit more, both morphologically and immunohistochemically. And they, of course, noted that that entrapped epithelium could really be quite atypical with reactive or regenerative features that in kind of a not circumspectly thinking about it, it certainly could mimic neoplasia. And they found what they felt were four distinct morphologic patterns of this diffuse respiratory epithelial entrapment. And the most common pattern seen in about three-quarters of the cases was it mimicked an adenofibroma or what one would see in a hamartoma, where you've got this sclerosing, posicellular lesion that was leaf-like with this epithelium lining that. And one of those turned out to be, two of those turned out to be primary pulmonary solitary fibrous tumors. There was one PEComa and one metastatic Wilms tumor, and the rest were various sarcomas. A second pattern mimicked an adenomyoepithelioma, and with its biphasic look, and that was an atypical fibrous histiocytoma. And then a really tricky one was the monophasic spindle cell synovial sarcoma that was metastatic to the lung but had entrapped respiratory epithelium that made it appear as if it was a biphasic synovial sarcoma. And then another pattern was more of a nondescript kind of, it resembled a pleuropulmonary blastoma, and that was actually a metastatic embryonal rhabdomyosarcoma. And out of all their cases that they looked at, only one they felt to represent a true pulmonary adenofibroma. And it's worth taking a look at the pictures and the tables of what was what in terms of this, just to imprint on what they were seeing. And what they caution, of course, is that it's not uncommon for non-epithelial neoplasms to have respiratory epithelial entrapment. And the most common pattern that can mimic is adenofibroma. And, of course, that has clinical consequences for diagnosing one for the other. And so the caveat is when you see a biphasic neoplasm in the lung that it looks like adenofibroma, don't assume that it is. It's a diagnosis of exclusion. And have a low threshold for using immunohistochemistry to see whether that epithelial component is pneumocytic or not. So, open for discussion on this. I thought it was a really interesting reminder to always think about these things. I'd love to hear from other people with their experience. I know we had a case here of metastatic endometrial stromal sarcoma that the initial impression by someone was that it was an adenofibroma, so I can certainly appreciate what they're talking about here in terms of the caveats.
How do you know an adenofibroma isn't just a fibroma with entrapped epithelium?
Right, Tom. They didn't go into, I'd have to look through the article a little bit more of why they came to the conclusion that their true adenofibroma was as such. and I'm probably not going to find the rationale on a quick look here.
And then I have a question for the rest of the group. I think I know Schuster and Moran had another little series of adenofibroma recently, but has anybody seen one of those?
I'm not sure I have.
Missed it.
Yeah, ditto.
Well, what did you guys call yours instead?
Wasn't that an old term, Tom, that used to be applied to hamartomas? I just assumed that was a misnomer.
Well, I think that they both are true, yes. About 15 years ago, Schuster and Moran reported two cases of adenofibroma. And I remember asking Saul once, well, how do you know those aren't solitary fibrous tumors, you know, with entrapped epithelium, and that was before STAT6 and that sort of thing. And then just recently, we may have discussed at the journal club, they had a series of another five or six or something cases, and I still am not sure that I've ever seen that and made that diagnosis.
I know, Tom. I'm hoping that that article gets discussed in an upcoming journal club, because I was surprised in the discussion of the article you're mentioning that they didn't talk at all, it seems, about including metastatic Mullerian origin spindle cell neoplasms in their discussion, and I was surprised that didn't get talked about at all.
Yeah, Jeff, I don't know if you remember, but years ago we sent the case, like, you know, with this sort of a problem to Anna, and I just remember her saying she gives broad birth to, you know, epithelium that looks like it's entrapped and almost always says that it's entrapped epithelium. So maybe that's been my bias all along, you know.
That's my bias. I mean, I don't believe otherwise. In fact, you know, there's some, quote, molecular data, close quotes, that shows the entrapped pneumocytes and a sclerosing pneumocytoma are neoplastic, and I don't believe that for a minute. I mean, they just look like entrapped pneumocytes. It's how they stain, and that's a very, very common phenomenon. So I don't know how you would ever kind of establish that one way or the other in a believable way.
Yeah.
They did say of their, quote, true adenofibroma in this particular study that the entrapped epithelium was positive for NAPSIN and TTF1, and that the stromal component was negative for ER and PR and STAT6. So it is kind of circular logic. But anyway, something to always keep in the back of the mind there. And I know that, Tom, was it you that published on metastatic, atypical dermatofibroma, or
yeah,
am I
misremembering
that?
Before we knew
that
they were metastatic, we called them cystic fibrohistiocytic tumors.
Yes.
And then we discovered they were really metastatic, and yeah, those can be both cystic and have entrapped epithelium, so that a fibrous proliferation from some other site could conceivably go to the lung and have entrapped epithelium. You know, it's a sort of an insoluble circular argument as to what the epithelium is. But I've never seen anything I've called adenofibroma.
Yeah. So whoever's month is for the newer adenofibroma article in AGSP, we'll have more to come in terms of that, I think. All right. Well, moving on, we've got spanning the spectra here, a non-morphologic study, and we'll talk about everybody's favorite topic, statistics. But statistics for a reason. So the next article, the lead author is Alberto Marcheschi, and he says pathologists should probably forget about kappa. And I thought that was intriguing because some of these authors in this study have published multiple papers on intra-observer variability and kappa statistics. So there you go. But kappa, as people are probably familiar with, I believe, was mostly used in the psychosomatic or psychiatric literature for the scales of inter-observer variability, but somewhere along the way in pathologist inter-agreement studies, someone co-opted Kappa statistics to use in terms of agreement. And the authors of this study looked at, well, is that an appropriate tool to use? And the methods are kind of wandering, I must say, in this study, but it appears as though they looked at five recent inter-observer variability studies that were pathology-based, and they looked at how the Kappa values were used and whether the conclusions that were drawn from those studies were made on those Kappa values and how they were made. And then they specifically pulled out one of the studies that, in fact, the senior author on the paper was part of, and it was a reproducibility study about about lung neuroendocrine neoplasms. And they reviewed the actual data set from that study that had just reported things in terms of Kappa values. And that study looked at whether immunohistochemistry improves the diagnosis of small cell carcinoma. And among 19 pathologists who looked at 74 challenging neuroendocrine tumors in that study, they got a Kappa value that ranged from fair to good in the original study. But the authors in the current study relooked at that data, and they simply looked at, it compared the consensus majority diagnosis for each of those 74 cases, and they made that the gold reference or the ground truth. And when they looked at the percent of people who actually aligned with that gold standard diagnosis, over 90% of the time, the pathologists involved match the gold reference diagnosis, whether it be separating typical carcinoid from atypical and small cell and large cell neuroendocrine. So even though the Kappa range from fair to good, you could get over a 90% specificity when you looked at it in a different way. So the authors proposed we need to get rid of Kappa values when we look at inter-observer variability studies in pathology, and really the important thing that should be looked at is sensitivity, specificity, positive and negative predictive value. So I thought this was, I would embrace that, and I'm sure others have comments about it, how it struck them.
My first comment is, why is this in Annals of Diagnostic Pathology and not another journal?
Well, I probably I believe that one of the authors is on the editorial board of that journal, and they probably came around to their turn, and there you go. Although that's pure speculation on my part.
I would wonder if this hasn't been submitted to a bunch of journals and they reject it.
Got it.
And the second thing that, I'm not very good at statistics, but it seems to me it took us long enough to accept the idea of looking at inter-observer variability. And I may be wrong here, they're suggesting that we should find a ground truth. And so that if you have a ground truth, then that may be true. But if you don't have a ground truth, such as whether two observers agree with one each other on prostate cancer diagnosis, then that's a little bit different. And I think the Kappa value still is valuable in that if it's low, we all know what that means. It may not be, quote, truth, but at least we have an idea of what it means. So that pure inter-observer variability between two observers, neither of whom is ground truth, to me, it still has value.
Got it. I guess what they're arguing is that we should pursue the lemur or the lemmings principle of all the lemmings go down into the ill-infested water at once, and that's more palatable than not. I don't know. I totally hear your point.
Anybody else have any thoughts about this? I mean, to me, this is a little bit too esoteric for pathologists.
It I don't know. For this pathologist.
Yeah, I'd have to read the paper to comment, Kelly. I just don't think about these things on a daily basis.
Yeah, I know. I guess it was the reason I picked it and I thought it was curious is that I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing Dr. Thunesen has published these multiple different types of studies on intra-observer variability. This one on can we get to a more accurate diagnosis of small cell using immunohistochemistry. He published another paper that people are probably familiar with and gets quoted a lot on inter-observer variability in typical and difficult cases of adenocarcinoma, how much invasion there is or not, and subtyping. And so there just seems to have been a proliferation of papers on using Kappa statistics. And it's curious whether that's the right way to go or not. At the end of the day, for the patient, do we care how much variability there is, or does the individual pathologist get it right most of the time, I guess?
I guess it all depends on whether you decide that there is a ground truth.
Got it. All right.
He's arbitrarily saying, or they are arbitrarily saying, well, settle on a ground truth, and then you can see how well people agree with that.
Right, right. I don't know. I think perhaps as a group we can publish a philosophical meandering paper about this and see where ground truth is.
Maybe the message is that we should look at all the findings and not just rely on one thing, like the Kappa. We should look at everything very objectively and decide which statistical finding, you know, how they all agree with each other. Well, shouldn't say agree here, but we should look at the whole thing together and not just rely on Kappa as the be-all and end-all.
Margaret, I have enough trouble getting used to Kappa, much less anything more.
All right. Well, rounding out today, Dr. Myers is part of a multi-author study, or clinical practice guideline, I should say, on hypersensitivity pneumonitis. And this is certainly a tour de force that you need to have in your files for everything you wanted to know and more about the whole general spectrum of hypersensitivity pneumonitis. And I thought it was interesting and helpful that they tried to separate out patients who have fibrotic and don't have fibrotic changes on imaging and what to do with them. And the takeaway that I got was that patients who have fibrosis, unless there are other clinical manifestations or laboratory manifestations that you can really cinch the diagnosis of HP, you need to go to biopsy. And in patients that aren't fibrotic, it's suggested, but try to do all that you can with your other parameters before going straight to biopsy on those patients. There's a lot of very nice background information. And want to point out that you need to look at Table 7, which is where it's at in terms of looks very similar to the table that we have for UIP-IPF in terms of probable, indeterminate, or definite HP. Just if you're ever given a talk on HP and in fact, in practice, too, making sure you're getting all the criteria that you need to there. Also, there are some very nice photomicrographs and point out a nice algorithmic approach that involves the clinical aspects of it as well in terms of what to do in Figure 7 in terms of how one actually gets to a diagnosis of HP. But probably the most important aspect of the article is all of the amazing things that people can be exposed to that lead to HP. Always find that illuminating and fascinating, and so I invite people to look at those, even consult some of the original articles for some entertainment value. So good work, Jeff.
How about that?
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Do you drink horchata? I mean, is that first-hand experience?
No, but I feel like the next time that we should get together in person as a group that we should partake of that.
I think maybe we should. I thought that was awesome.
Jeff?
I like the idea of getting together. We should plan our own little meeting sometime. That has some merit.
Exactly.
You know, the one thing that struck me about this paper, and Jeff, you might want to comment, is, I mean, this is an enormous paper, like Kelly said, a real tour de force, and yet the length of the paper, I think, says something about how challenging this diagnosis still is, and at the end of the day, I didn't take away much more than what I already use now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I read it, and I thought, well, that was a lot of words, but I'm no more educated about how to get to a diagnosis.
I couldn't agree more.
It's because you're very educated already, Henry.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, compared to most pathologists, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about it.
Yeah, Jeff, I agree.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I just, like, wow. It's hard. This is still a hard diagnosis, and nobody really knows how to make it. That was my takeaway.
And I'm still amazed at how many people say don't do a surgical lung biopsy on these patients.
Yeah, because I think the
mortality, morbidity.
Yeah, the histology in many cases is just, you know, it's pretty classic. I mean, you know, there's all the caveats that we all put in the report, but at the end of the day, we feel pretty confident that the pathology is going to support an HP diagnosis. Well, thank you, Kelly, for a good...
Of course. I'd be remiss. Jen Bolin has an article on Ki-67 labeling in carcinoid tumors that time didn't permit us to discuss today. And then there is of somewhat interest, Griffin and colleagues looked at their experience with digital pathology for intraoperative frozen section. And I think you should look at the types of misses that they had and just remind yourself of all the... things that can go wrong, not necessarily with digital pathology itself, but frozen section diagnoses that become more clear on permanent sections. And with that, I wish everyone a great day, and thanks for coming.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kelly.